The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today William T. Volman. He joins us on the telephone in Sacramento. Hello, Bill.
Hey, nice to talk to you again.
Bill, I think I mentioned to you during our last interview how excited I was about interviewing you the first time, and that was just recently because you have put out a book that was so massive that your publisher had to split it into two volumes, and now the second volume has come out, and here you are again, and it's
That's
really...
Yeah, it was an accident, Vic. I promise it won't happen again.
I'm happy if it happens again.
Well, I am happy, too. I like talking to you.
I'm a fan of your work, as you know.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bill, the first book, the first volume is called No Immediate Danger, and the new one... The second volume is called No Good Alternative, and these are volume one and volume two of the Carbon Ideologies. What made you decide to write these?
Well, I am very fond of my daughter, who is now getting pretty big. She's in college, and I started thinking maybe I should take climate change more seriously, just to kind of imagine what the world would be like for her after I was gone. And it was not a pretty picture. The more I looked into it, the more alarmed I became, and I decided that I would do what little I could to bring attention to this topic, knowing quite well that it is probably too late anyhow.
You're saying it's too late while we have millions of people who don't even think there's a problem. Why do you think it is that it's so easy for so many people to just pretend this isn't happening?
Well, it's a way of being that has worked for us humans always, and it has worked for plants and animals quite well, too. When some organism has enough of the resources required for survival, the next step is to reproduce, to grow larger, and just use those resources. And, you know, that's kind of a sign of biological success. So we have found a way, amazingly enough, to tap into the bygone energy of the sun. All those plants and other things that have turned into fossil fuels a long, long time ago, we found that we can burn those and thereby do mechanical, all kinds of amazing, non-complaining slaves, such as the giant HVAC units on my roof that will warm or cool my studio at the push of a button. I've never had it so good. You know, why on earth wouldn't I not want to have that stuff? And why wouldn't people in Bangladesh, where it's so just hot and sweltering and miserable, why wouldn't they too like to have air conditioning? So if someone comes along and says, hey, Bill, guess what? What you're doing is really, really bad for the planet. It's bad for all of us, and I want you to stop. I might say, well, let's see, why don't you take a long time trying to prove it to me so I can keep my air conditioner on in the meantime. That's human nature.
We seem to be different, though, than all these other organisms. We seem to not be able to decide when it's too much, when there are too many of us, when we are too greedy, when we want to consume too much. The term consumer itself...
It's kind of a vile word, I think.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it seems as if for other organisms, it's, you know, so-called ecology that decides. So when there are too many deer or rabbits, then either they overgraze and starve to death, or else the predators multiply and call them back that way. We don't fancy being eaten when there are too many of us. So what we really should think about is birth control. If we don't want to do that, or if we don't do that enough, then we have to figure out how to reduce our demand for everything. And if we can do that, then maybe we can stay in the game a little longer. But it's very, very unnatural for any organism to reduce its demand. So I take the long view, which comforts me. These books are a letter to the future, to a very, very hot, dark, radioactive, impoverished, even desperate future. And my main point, I think, to these people is, please try to forgive us. We were very, very selfish and short-sighted, and I'll bet you would do the same in our shoes.
We take great pride in our predatory skills. And,
that's right.
We're very good at it. We wiped out the bison. We wiped out the passenger pigeons. And finally, we're going to wipe ourselves out.
Good chance, I would say.
The book is No Good Alternative. It's volume 2 of Carbon Ideologies. My guest is William T. Volman. You spend a lot of time in this volume in coal country. You spend a lot of time in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And this was a real eye-opener for me as a reader. I had heard about mountaintop removal. I had heard about all the environmental devastation that's been going on, but I had no clue how bad it is.
Yeah, those places really look awful. And from what I gather, there is no way, at least currently known, to actually seal off all the heavy metals once the mountaintop removal is finished. So the coal tends to be bound up with heavy metals because when the coal was alive, the roots of the plants were pulling in heavy metals. That's what they do. So fast forward a few million years, and there's a bunch of coal inside a mountain, well inside it, with soil and trees on the outside. And then the mountaintop removers come, take off the top of the mountain, and then when they're done, they might plant some grass or some trees so that, as somebody told me, it'll look good from a freeway if you're driving past at high speed. But whenever it rains, heavy metals are going to wash out. Meanwhile, a lot of the so-called overburden, the rocks and soil and so forth that had to be removed, is down at the bottom of the valley of the holler, as they call it. And so the streams are wrecked. It's very, very ugly and very, very unhealthy, too. There are high rates of cancers and birth defects around these places. And most of the people I met in West Virginia were willing to say off the record that they were not in favor of mountaintop removal. But most people are in favor of coal mining, and I don't blame them. I mean, what we need to do for people in Appalachia is say, thank you so much, you know, for, as you put it, keeping the lights on, and we want to transfer some wealth to you. Let's have you build some Appalachian solar collectors, and we're going to pay you well for them, and we're not going to just blame you for coal and leave you impoverished and forgotten.
In that coal section, you talk a lot about what I think is a classic oxymoron, and that is what they call the regulated community. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, we often see that phrase being used in that area for any sort of company, particularly a large company involved in resource extraction. And the state politicians will say up front, you know, we want to be really, really gentle on the regulated community. We want those people, you know, to not be afraid when we come. And I hate to say it, but West Virginia seems like a pretty corrupt place. And as far as I can tell, the regulated community runs the lawmakers. They are all willing to do away with renewables, to do whatever they can to fight this supposed war on coal. And they're just so hyped up that anything that might maybe keep a stream from dying or keep people from getting sick from coal is some horrible communistic thing that's being imposed by outsiders, and you have to stand up against it. It's really quite shocking to look at some of the bills that have been passed. There was, when I was in West Virginia, there was a huge spill of a coal cleaning chemical called MCHM, and it affected the drinking water of several hundred thousand people, some of them even outside of West Virginia. For a while, people were told they couldn't even take showers in the stuff. It had a very strong smell of licorice, and it seemed as if it might be very, very toxic. The cause of this spill was a bunch of poorly regulated tanks filled with MCHM very close to the intake of some drinking water. So the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, passed a bill saying that for reasons of security against terrorism, you are not allowed to report on the location or contents of any of these tanks unless you have permission, you know, from the industry.
And the regulators should be people like people in the legislature or even the governor, heaven forbid. Tell us about the governor of West Virginia.
Well, I had the chance when I went to Eastern Kentucky to meet a former mining inspector named Stanley Sturgill, who was a coal miner for most of his life and then gradually became an anti-mining activist. And he said, "Bill, I want to take you and show you what Jim Justice left us." So we drove up over the mountain. We were looking down on Wise, Virginia, where there was one of Jim Justice's mines. And we actually poked around in the mine, and it was just such a vile place. It was completely unremediated. It was like this huge, arid bowl, just stripped. And there was a filthy pool of water at the bottom. The opening to the mine had not been sealed up. And I said, "Well, Stanley, I thought that they're supposed to remediate a little bit better than this." And he just laughed and said, "Oh, yeah, they are." Well, in 2014, Mr. Justice owed something like $2 million in unpaid fines for breaches of mine safety. And Justice's mines had more than 4,000 violations, and 1,300 of those were considered reasonably likely to cause injury or illness, and a lot of those were really, really worse. So Mr. Justice is now the governor of West Virginia. He says he wants to run the state more like a business. So I imagine he wants to run the state like one of his businesses.
Oh, my. Well, you must have watched in shock to see that we have another mining magnate in West Virginia who really wants to be our next U.S. senator from West Virginia. He ran for the primary nomination as a Republican, and he failed at that, and now he's trying to run as an independent or actually from another party. And the guy that he's hoping to unseat, the Democrat, Joe Manchin, he doesn't come off very well in your book either.
No, no, none of them do. What really blew my mind was, I have a little table about it, actually. There was a Board of Education science standards, and at some point, the West Virginians decided that maybe it might be worth teaching the students about, you know, the rise in global temperatures as part of science. You know, it is an important aspect of our world. And so the board decided that what they had better do was change it to the rise and fall, or the warming and cooling of temperatures over time. And there was somebody from the local newspaper who called all these people up and said, well, you know, what do you think? And they all either said, well, I don't know anything, or they hung up on him. And I had a friend and assistant try to contact all of these people just to say, well, what do you think about climate change? Not one of them even responded. And I believe that we can debate in good faith with people who do not believe in climate change. We can say, all right, show us your measurements, your numbers, and your predictions. And here are ours. Let's look at them and see what we think. And let's try to come to an agreement, you know, in good faith, and you know, really conclude this matter. But when what you get instead is the no comment, you tend to think, well, that's an admission of guilt, or at least an admission of secrecy. And, you know, to me, that just doesn't play very well.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. It's the Book Nook, and William T. Volman has returned to the program for the second half of his massive Carbon Ideologies. It's called No Good Alternative, Volume 2, and there's so much in this book. And the coal section is a big section. We find out that the carbon dioxide that we're so concerned about, the greenhouse gas, is much surpassed in danger by the gas methane. You tell us all about that. Then we have a little adventure in fracking, and I didn't realize how insidious this practice is until I read your book, Bill.
I know, it's quite discouraging because we all love energy, and I really wish that at least one of these fuels was wonderful. But I don't think that fracking is the answer. It is true that natural gas, when burned, releases less CO2 than the other carbon-based fuels by certain measurements. The problem is that natural gas in pipelines and wells leaks in vast quantities, and one of its main constituents is the very, very dangerous greenhouse gas methane. Methane is something like 86 times worse in terms of global warming than CO2 over the first 20 years, after which it gradually turns into CO2, where it will continue to warm our planet for thousands and thousands of years. But the other thing that is really bad about fracking is that it releases, I can't say it always does, but it often does, some volatile organic compounds that can make people very, very sick.
Hmm. I printed out a graph from the last part of May, which just ended, showing U.S. daily record highs tied or broken over May 22nd through May 28th. I see here on May 27th, over 500 of them broken, almost 550 across the U.S. It's just, we just keep heating up, don't we?
That is for sure. But, you know, Vic, the good news is that however hot it is this year, in a few years, we're going to say, oh, if only it was as cool as in 2018. So we might as well enjoy it.
Well, we are enjoying it, aren't we?
We definitely are.
Bill, don't you encounter people all the time and say, what a beautiful day, I love this warm weather? Don't you encounter that a lot?
Yes, especially in winter. And I don't want to rain on people's parade. So given that it probably is too late, if people can be in the sweet spot of global warming and appreciate it, well, that's not going to make our situation any better or any worse. So more power to them, I say.
Bill, you did try to get the other side on this. With all the no comments that you got, you did have some people talk to you who are from various industry groups. You had this gentleman, a fascinating gentleman from Conoco. He's a really interesting guy.
I was so grateful to him, yeah. He was a really neat man. And Mr. Archie Dunham, and he doesn't especially think that climate change is that big a deal. And one thing he said, you know, which is quite reasonable and we need to address, is that, first of all, how can we be so sure what the ocean temperature or level was 100 years ago? And how can we be sure if we transfer billions of dollars a year, say, to China and India by cutting back our emissions, that they will actually cut their emissions too? So I can see his point of view. I believe that, in fact, there is good scientific evidence based on ice cores in Greenland for understanding CO2 levels in the atmosphere going way, way back. And there are tidal gauge measurements that are fairly accurate going back 100 years. And there has been a steady increase in sea level. So over most of the 20th century, it was something like 1.7 millimeters a year. And now I think it's more like 3.2. So there I do differ with Mr. Dunham. I think we are, you know, in an alarming situation. But, you know, I can see where he's coming from when he says, well, why does the U.S. have to unilaterally do all these things? So I'm grateful that Japan and the EU is doing far more than we are. I would like to see India and China are really ramping up their greenhouse gases, actually show some heart. And, of course, I would like to see us show some heart, too.
Bill, you did extensive research for this book. You traveled all over the world burning up that jet fuel.
You sure did.
You went to places like the United Arab Emirates. In the first book, you make 5 trips to Japan. In the second volume, you're talking about being on one of those bullet trains in Japan, enjoying the comfort of speeding along in that bullet train. And when you went to the Emirates, that was another eye-opener for me as a reader. You interviewed a lot of guest workers, and it was appalling to see how much they were being paid for their work and just to see the greed and the weird society they've created over there.
Yeah, very strange. And as long as there is a gradient of income, we're always going to see something like that. You know, a lot of the guest workers were from Cameroon. And if Cameroon has a GDP of, let's say, 1, you know, which is about, I think it's $3,000 per capita, and the Emirates has a GDP, you know, 22 times that, then, of course, people from Cameroon are going to come and be security guards. People from Pakistan, which is about, I think it's about 1.6 times better in terms of GDP, are going to come and work with oil extraction and related industries, and they're going to feel somewhat grateful to live in these crummy conditions where they're breathing in a lot of sulfur. The UAE oil has a lot of sulfur in it that is really, really foul and sickening to people. They're living in these so-called bed spaces that are segregated ethnically, usually. So there might be one place that has, you know, let's say 10 men from India all in one room in bunks. And they say they get along, you know, because they all come from the same place, can speak the same language. But it's a pretty dreary life, for sure. And most of them, like so many of us, do not really understand climate change. They know that when they're around the oil in these refineries, that it's got a bad smell and sometimes they feel sick. But, you know, they're still hoping, just as all the rest of us are, that for some kind of magic energy bullet. Like so many of them said, well, Bill, why don't we just have electric cars?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing is that you need batteries for electric cars and you need energy to make and charge those batteries. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately. It's like wishing for Santa Claus.
It seemed to be a universal misperception on their parts that, well, we don't need this oil. We'll just use electricity, not realizing that the one produces the other.
That's right. And it gets back to this whole idea about just doing what humans do. You know, I'm pushing 60. I'll be 59 in July. So, of course, I'm declining, but I don't want to believe it, right? I want to think that I'm going to be happier, healthier, more successful 10 years from now than I am. My future is going to get better and better, when, of course, my future is a hole in the ground. That's everyone's future. And who wants to face it? Who wants to face what we're doing to ourselves and our planet? That's human nature.
Mm. Well, Bill, You have almost a gallows humor in this. And as
you might as well laugh, right?
Yeah, and as you indicated, this is written to that person in the future who might discover this ancient text. And you have a section here, and these are the parts that I look for, where you're actually envisioning what that future might be like. And I want to quote you from near the end of the book where you write, "I think I can almost see you toiling in your radioactive fields, plowing your top 15 centimeters of dirt deep under to keep fallout products well below the roots of whatever spindly crop you can still grow in between droughts and megastorms. You must be munching on insects, covering up against the sun, pollinating by hand, breathing smoke, keeping your children cool in caves and holes, collecting acid rain to drink, and looking over your shoulder for the next catastrophe." Whoa.
Sounds pretty good, Vic. I can hardly wait. How about you?
Oh, Bill, I think you and I will be in those holes long before. Well, it is happening faster than even the predictions, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I have one chapter near the end called Faster Than the Worst Case Scenario, because so many things are happening worst and faster than people could have imagined.
What kind of response have you gotten, Bill, to the book?
Oh, let's see. People say, when are you going to write some fiction again?
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the main one. And who can blame them?
Help us escape, Bill. Help us.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show again, Bill.
Oh, well, it's been really nice to talk to you, Vic. And if you are ever out here, come and have a drink with me.
I would love that. Now, do you live in a, it used to be a paint store?
I live in what used to be a Mexican restaurant.
Oh.
My studio, but I also have a home where I live with my family.
Okay, gotcha. Well, if I'm ever in Sacramento, Bill, I'm going to take you up on that. So be careful what you ask for.
Okay. You've
been listening to the Book Nook on WISO. My guest has been William T. Volman, and Volume 2 of The Carbon Ideologies is No Good Alternative. Volume 1 is No Immediate Danger for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.